Masale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. And before we get started, I want to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, November 23rd. In 1749, a man who would become a reluctant participant in America's move toward independence is born. Edward Rutledge of South Carolina was one of the delegates to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, but along with John Jay and others, he was a bit hesitant to completely sever ties with England and declare war on the Mother Kingdom. Rutledge eventually had a change of heart, and at the age of 26 was the youngest delegate to sign the Declaration of Independence. In 1859, a boy who would become one of the scourges of the American West was born in New York City. William H. Bonney, better known as Billy the Kid, was a homely-looking character with a very young face who shocked bank tellers across the Southwest as he held up a gun and demanded money. He robbed his way from Utah to Oklahoma and even made it into a popular song a century later titled The Ballad of Billy the Kid by another William, Billy Joel. And in 1936, the first issue of Life magazine is published, eventually to become one of the most popular in America due to its vivid photography and stories about life in small towns and out-of-the-way places, illustrated by spectacular images which grabbed readers' attention for decades. Life stopped publication in 1972, but came back in 2004 as a supplement in some U.S. newspapers. To many people, history is, quite frankly, just a tad boring. Names and dates and battles that they were forced to memorize in fourth grade. This show tries to make history come alive with interesting interviews of the people, places, and events that have made America a fascinating and very special place. Some historians really do get it. They are great professors of history, excellent lecturers, and gifted storytellers. They bring history to life with interesting commentaries and also historical fiction, which highlight many facets of our heritage which people don't know or understand. One man has not only pursued history, he's been part of it for his entire career. Dr. Stanley Carpenter is a professor of history at American Public University, an author of several books of both history and historical fiction, and a 30-year veteran of the United States Navy, in which he served from 1979 to 2009, including participation in the Persian Gulf and other theaters. Dr. Carpenter is well-versed in both British and American history. And for full disclosure, I must note that he is currently my master's thesis advisor at APU, providing much valuable assistance and useful recommendations as I write my thesis on another historical figure, Alexander Hamilton. Dr. Carpenter also teaches at the Naval War College with a wide range of pursuits, and he's here with us today. Dr. Carpenter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gene. A pleasure and honor to be here.
Now, thank you for being with us. Now, you were teaching at APU for many, many years. Just tell us a little bit about your background there.
Well, I started, I think it was probably about 1995 or so, and I was working on my, actually on my doctoral dissertation at the time at Florida State University, and I saw an ad for then American Military University. They were just firing up what was essentially an old paper correspondence program and just getting started, and I said, I'd love to teach a course for you, and they signed me up to do their British military history course. It was an undergraduate course, and gradually the university expanded and became affiliated with the American Public University system, and at one point had over 70,000 students, all completely online. Mm-hmm. And I started, once I had my doctorate, I started teaching graduate courses. So I've done everything from ancient Greece and Rome and the Byzantine Empire all the way up to modern military history. And I would say my specialties right now probably are ancient Greece, Rome, and the American Revolution. And of course, you were writing your master's thesis for me in that period on Alexander Hamilton. So I've done it for about 20-some years with American Public University.
Very good. Now, you've got a background with a bit of an emphasis on, I think, British history. You went to the University of St. Andrews. Now, just curious, is that anywhere near the famous golf course?
It absolutely is, and I am one of the lucky few that have been able to play golf in St. Andrews. There are actually about four courses, and included in that is the old course, which is a famous one. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, they're building a few more. So those golfers among us who want to play in St. Andrews but can't necessarily get onto the old course, there are plenty of other ones. But I did. I studied primarily British military history, concentrating on the 18th century when I was doing my master's degree in Scotland in St. Andrews. Mm-hmm. And then when I returned to the United States, that's when I reported to Officer Candidate School for the Navy.
Mm-hmm. Now, what brought you to the Department of War Studies at King's College, University of London?
I did do a term there in between St. Andrews, the master's degree there, and coming back to the United States. I had known about that program and wanted to get the one-year master's degree, but unfortunately, and this happens to a lot of us, ran out of money. And mm-hmm. rather than taking a large student loan to finish that degree when I knew full well that I was going to embark on a Navy career, I essentially pulled out, and now I wish I had that degree, but I don't.
Nope.
It was just a financial question.
Certainly. Just curious, I am just guessing that the British have a little bit different view of the Revolutionary War compared to our view. What did you glean from your studies with their books and their teachers and professors?
Well, it's interesting that the attitude is very pro-American, and I'll just tell you a real quick story to illustrate that. I was over in 2010 doing some research on a book. In fact, it's about to be published by University of Oklahoma Press on the Southern Campaign of the American Revolution. I was doing research in London, and I said, I've never been to Hadrian's Wall as much time as I've spent living in Britain. So I took a couple of days off, drove up, visited Hadrian's Wall, and on the way back from the north, about 10 miles south of the city of Newcastle, there's a little village called Washington. And this actually is where the Washington family originated. They were royalists in the British Civil Wars of the 1640s, and like a lot of those families, they left in the 1650s and came to primarily Virginia and South Carolina. And so it was the little town of Washington. So I pulled off the motorway, gas up the car, get my Diet Coke, and as I was paying for it, there was the archetypal young teenage girl manning the cash register. And I said to her, you know, this is where General George Washington's family came from. And she just smiled and said, yes, sir, and we're very proud of the general.
That's interesting.
And there's also a story. I'm not sure if this is true, but apparently when King George III was told that George Washington had turned down the crown when he was offered to be King George of America, mm-hmm. George III said, if that be true, he is the greatest man in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over the years, that relationship between Britain and the United States has really flourished. And in spite of what some people might try to tell you, the general attitude towards Americans and Britain is extremely positive. Mm-hmm. And I would say if I had to capture it, the attitude of most Britons is looking at America, the attitude would be, look what we spawned.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a tremendous amount of pride in look what we created or look what we spawned. So I found that it was very pleasant living in Britain, and they really do like Yanks.
Oh, my travels over there really do confirm exactly what you just said. It's an absolutely beautiful country, and I've always had wonderful interactions with the people there. Now, you were in the Navy for 30 years, a very long career. you were a commission as an officer from, I guess, officer candidate school in 1979, and you became a captain. And just tell us a little bit about your background in the Navy. And by the way, thank you so much for your service.
Well, it was a pleasure and honor. And just FYI, I'm sitting here in the car and I'm looking at the barracks that I lived in at Officer Candidate School. So it's located right here at the same naval station as the Naval War College. Mm-hmm. I spent 5 years active duty and then 25 years Navy Reserve. Mm. And in that time, I had 4 commanding officer tours, a chief staff officer tour, and an executive officer tour. So I really was able to flourish and do well. I would go back in a heartbeat, but they just don't want us old fat men. it would take a mighty big war or something really disastrous. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was a pleasure and an honor to serve. As I said, my background is pretty wide. I started out as the communications officer on a cruiser, and it was a flagship cruiser, so I had a lot of interaction with flag staffs and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I actually was split toured. I didn't complete my 3 years on the cruiser. They grabbed me and sent me to a an amphibious squadron as the communications officer, which was a billet that normally would be a full lieutenant, and I was just barely lieutenant junior grade. So I got off to a good start there. In the interim, I have served on amphibious ships, on destroyers, on amphibious and destroyer squadron staff. I was CO of a naval communication station detachment. And and my last couple of billets were actually in what's called the Defense Support of Civil Authorities, or DISCA. Mm. And so anytime you hear a storm, think Sandy or think Katrina or some event where the civil authorities ask the Department of Defense for support or help, and the liaison officers representing their service, which is the billet that I had, essentially are that link between the civil authorities and the military. And it's a very important function, and I was very pleased to be involved in that aspect of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. So I've had a really wide, broad-ranging career, and I thought a very full and fulfilling career.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're just about to take a brief break for a commercial, but real quickly, you also had some experience in the Persian Gulf. I think you mentioned Operation Earnest Will. What was that all about, just briefly?
Right. That was the tanker war in the 1980s, the Iran-Iraq war, and the Iranians started attacking Kuwaiti tankers who were supporting the Iraqis, and so we reflagged those tankers as U.S. ships and put Navy support on them. So I was, as a liaison officer, riding the tankers, and it's the real comeuppance to stand there on the side of the ship and watch an Iranian mine float 20 yards down your starboard side.
Oh, my Lord. Yes, yeah. Pretty exciting stuff. We are just about to take a break, but everyone, please stay with us. We'll be back with Dr. Stanley Carpenter discussing his service and his writings.
Do you have a wedding, graduation, baptism, confirmation, milestone, or birthday to plan? You need John Surratt Catering, one of the most highly rated and preferred caterers throughout the Philadelphia area. They will be there to create and cater your event while assisting as much or as little as you desire. Planning a decadent, over-the-top company gala? Need help transforming your backyard into the party of the year? Want to wow your clients with a delicious luncheon? Then you need John Surratt Catering. All you have to do is call and they'll handle the rest. Located at 835 Lincoln Avenue in Westchester, visit them at SurrockCatering.com or call 610-640-2836. That's 610-640-2836.
If you had to choose a roofer, would you choose one with limited experience and knowledge, or would you choose a roofer certified as a master elite contractor by the largest manufacturer in the nation, GAF, a distinction shared by only 3% of the nation's roofers? I'm talking about GP Martini Roofing, who also does siding, windows, doors, and offers an ironclad guarantee that he'll repair or replace any roof for defects within its normal life. GP Martini Services, Chester, Delaware, Bucks, and Montgomery counties with free estimates and consultation, and does both commercial and residential. Go to their website at martiniroofing.com for special savings, or call 610-873-1696. And also, financing is available with no payments for a full year. Now, what roofer would you call? GP Martini is the answer, 610-873-1696.
WCHE 1520 AM, bringing you all things Chester County from our palatial studios on West Gay Street in Uptown Westchester, the talk of Chester County. If you don't believe it, just ask your neighbor. They listen.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Stanley Carpenter, who has served in the United States Navy for 30 years and teaches at the Naval War College and also at American Public University. Dr. Carpenter, you've taught at APU for, I guess, just over 20 years now. Tell us about some of the courses you teach there.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I've done everything from the ancient world to the modern world. Included in that would be ancient Greece, ancient Rome, the Byzantine Empire, the Enlightenment, which is really the period that I focus on, the 18th century, 17th century, big specialties there. I've taught many American Revolution era courses. I think that's probably my primary one. But I also have taught U.S. Civil War courses, World War II, and modern wars. And so basically, across the gamut of world and American military history.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
the books you've written are really wide-ranging. I have a note here that you've written on the British Civil Wars, 1642 to 1651, an edited volume of English Civil War essays, as well as chapters on Admiral Thomas Moorer in the 19-gun salute, case studies of strategic and operational naval leadership, really several interesting books. Aside from one that just came out called, The Resurrection of Antimony? And that's an historical novel. So tell us a little bit about this most recent one that just came out.
Absolutely. And this relates back to something you said earlier. You mentioned Life magazine. And that has a lot to play with the story behind the story. Those of us of a certain age will remember back in the 80s that Time Life Books came out with a whole series of books. There was the Westerns, there was the Air History, there was a history of the Mariners and all. Mm-hmm. But they did a series, the World War II series. And I was looking through that, and in the volume on the Battle of the Atlantic, there was a chapter titled The Zany Saga of the Zamzam, Z-A-M-Z-A-M. I said, okay, well, that's intriguing. And what it is the Zamzam was an actual ship. She was an Egyptian-flagged ship in World War II, so she was neutral. But she was sailing from New York eventually to Alexandria, Egypt, but she had on board over 100 Americans, a lot of whom were Protestant missionaries going to Africa. But she also had a couple of dozen young male volunteer ambulance drivers, who mostly just college graduates, going off to drive ambulances for the Free French forces in Africa. But they also had a couple of dozen Royal Air Force wives who were going out to Egypt to join their RAF pilot husbands. And I'm thinking, here are all these types of people on board this derelict Egyptian liner heading across a war zone with German submarines and U-boats, and not to give away the story, but the Zamzam was in fact attacked and sunk, and it almost created another Lusitania-type affair, if you will, except turned out that she was actually sailing under British Admiralty orders to not fly a national ensign during the day and no running lights at night. which identifies you not as a neutral, but as a combatant.
Mm.
And so the theory is that they were trying to provoke another incident. This was in March of 1941, another Lusitania-type incident. So I said, this is no Hollywood screenwriter could come up with a better background or venue. So I created Antimony, who is a British naval intelligence officer brought back on active duty for World War II, and he's put on board the ship, and I won't go any further.
No, you
have to read the book.
Yeah, I'm looking at the write-up on Amazon.com, and by the way, you've gotten some very good reviews. It's listed as by S.D.M. Carpenter, and it's for our listeners, it's called A Resurrection of Antimony. And by the way, just to give you the intro, with Commodore John Brathwaite, retired British Royal Navy intelligence agent, leaps at the opportunity to return to the field to fight in the war. So, very interesting story. You've got several books out. The one on military leadership in the British Civil Wars, that's also on Amazon under Stanley D.M. Carpenter. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Sure, and just as a note here, when I publish fiction, it's under S.D.M. Carpenter, and if it's nonfiction or history, it's Stanley D.M. Carpenter, so I just make that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the military leadership book actually grew out of my doctoral dissertation, which was a case study analysis comparing several of the parliamentarian major commanders to the royalist major commanders.
Mm.
And not the ones that you usually think of, like King Charles I or Prince Rupert or Oliver Cromwell, but it's sort of the second level down of major commanders. And I essentially evaluated them compared to each other in terms of their military leadership as a way of explaining why the parliamentarian side eventually won. And my thesis advisor or dissertation advisor, Dr. Richard Grease, who was one of the giants in that period, Tudor Stuart studied, who since passed away, what he said to his graduate students was, you are not writing a doctoral dissertation, you are writing the book. And basically it was very easy to turn my dissertation into a book, and it was published first in 2005 in hardback, and then in 2006 in softback by Frank Cass, which is a major British publisher.
Interesting. You mentioned to me offline that your current project is about Lord Cornwallis and the Southern Campaign of 1778 to 1781, which will be coming out. Is that out yet from the University of Oklahoma Press?
That's University of Oklahoma Press. They have a very robust series, military history series, that they call Campaigns and Commanders.
Mm-hmm.
And I have long been an admirer of Lord Cornwallis. Strategically, he was not that adept. Nathaniel Greene ran rings around him, but in terms of a field commander, operational and tactical commander, he probably was the best of the war. And I've always had this soft spot for Lord Cornwallis. And growing up in North Carolina, where a lot of the Southern Campaign took place, and going to those battlefields like Guilford Courthouse and Kings Mountain, I just developed a feel for it. So it fits very nicely with my emphasis on British military history as a professor of strategy here at the Naval War College. It fits perfectly in there. American Revolution, or War for American Independence, we call it, is one of our major case studies here.
Mm-hmm.
So it just all fits together. And so the book hopefully will be out late 17, maybe early 18.
Excellent. Fascinating. Along those lines, in my research, I've come to know that the Howe brothers, William Howe and I guess Admiral Richard Howe, are supposed to have been somewhat sympathetic to the American cause. And some historians have even written, because they were, I guess, not so strongly against the Patriots, that maybe they didn't wage as effective a campaign as they could have. Maybe you could give us some more information on that.
Sure, and in fact, you would fit Lord Cornwallis in that as well. They were politically of the Whig Party, which was the party that was the opposition, not in power at the time. And they essentially said, hey, the American colonists have real legitimate political, constitutional, economic grievances that need to be addressed. But when the shooting started, and literally it was a rebellion that started, then they basically did their military duty and took up commands in the colonies. But because that they were somewhat sympathetic to the grievances of the colonials, the Howe brothers both were appointed as commissioners for the peace, with the idea of, okay, we'll thrash the Continental Army, we'll prove to them they cannot win, that it's a losing cause, now let's sit down and negotiate a settlement and address these grievances. But by the time that happened, the Continental Congress had already voted independency and really had changed the policy direction from a redress grievances to political independence, a brand new country.
Mm-hmm.
And so the representatives from Congress, which included Benjamin Franklin, met with the Howes and basically said, no, we're not going to do it. So there is something to that story, and I think the attitude of General Howe in particular was, beat them in the field, but don't crush them. Show that they cannot win, back off, and then negotiate.
Very interesting. Now, I believe there's also evidence that General Washington was, shall we say, a bit miffed, that he wasn't addressed as general in a letter. I believe it might have been from Howe or from Cornwallis, I'm not sure which, and therefore he was just absolutely angry at them. What's the background on that, do you know?
Well, that is true. There was a letter. And what's interesting is when you start reading about Washington and the original letters, the headquarters papers of the British Army, which were saved and preserved in the National Archives in London. Later in the war, he is referred to as General Washington. But there was a letter there, a famous letter, if you will, where he was referred to simply as Mr. Washington.
Now, I don't think he liked that. Maybe it helped him fight a little bit better. But at any rate, in terms of your favorite periods in world or even U.S. history, tell us about some of the episodes that you like the best.
Well, I think, obviously, War for American Independence period, World War One, which I'm doing a lot of work on right now academically. In fact, I'll probably be presenting a paper at the Society for Military History annual conference coming up next spring on the Austro-Hungarian Navy.
Mm.
So that's part of my naval history aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, World War II. I've always had a passion for World War II history,
mm-hmm.
Which I've done a lot of articles, journal-type articles, encyclopedia articles on both World War I and World War II. And, of course, there's always the British Civil War period, which is where I really started out academically.
Excellent, excellent. And you also do, I guess, a lot of interaction with professors and students on leadership and strategic thinking by senior commanders. Tell us just briefly about that.
Exactly. Well, that actually started way back well before I ever went to graduate school. I started thinking in terms of what really makes for an effective leader. And I started coming up in my mind what I thought were the traits and behaviors and characteristics of an effective leader. And that actually was the basis of that book that eventually became the British Military Leadership in the Civil Wars period. And the dissertation, is I essentially came up with what I thought were the chief characteristics of effective military leaders, things like moral authority, aggressiveness, boldness, these various characteristics. And so when I looked at the commanders on both the Royalist and the Parliamentarian side in the British Civil Wars, I essentially was comparing them to this rubric or matrix, if you will, of effective military leadership characteristics, and judging them by that. And that's sort of become an underlying theme in all my writings about military leadership, is how do they compare to what I call the model of effective military leadership.
Mm-hmm. And you've communicated to me offline that your main purpose is to teach military professionals the dynamics of critical analysis and strategic thinking, which I think is excellent, and something that many people throughout academia and industry could benefit from. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the strategy in war and the strategy and policy courses that we teach here at the Naval War College, the purpose is to teach you critical analysis and strategic thinking, So as I say to the classes, long after you've forgotten who shot John and how many cannons on the hill in terms of the historical case studies, if we have inculcated in you a pattern of strategic thinking and critical analysis, that's what we're looking for.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And I think that's quite valuable for our listeners. If you want to find his books, they are listed under S.D.M. Carpenter on Amazon and also Stanley D.M. Carpenter on Amazon. And by the way, they do get some excellent ratings, so I think you'll have an interest. Dr. Carpenter, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Next week, tune in on December 7th, 2016 at 1 p.m. Eastern, when we'll be speaking with Pat Morrison of the Pennsylvania Railroad Museum in Strasburg, PA. Thank you all for joining us today for Living History.